Hello, welcome to Weekly Geek Speak, the geekliest podcast in the land of geekly weeks, the weeks of the... No, this isn't working.
That's not the best you've done.
You're going to have to work on these, aren't you?
Yeah.
I was going for a story then. Welcome to Weekly Geek Speak, I'm Andrew.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Steve.
Yeah, you can find us on weeklygeekspeak.com, you can follow us on Twitter at weeklygeekspeak, find us on Facebook, we're also on iTunes, Stitcher and so forth. If you do want to subscribe to us, welcome to the show if you're new, and welcome back if you're not. How are you guys?
I'm very warm.
All right, yeah, we're all under a big duvet. Cover.
So if there's any squirming noises, that is what is going on.
It adds a nice little, like it's nice to chat with you.
We'll get more intimate and deep.
I think we might. You do. It'll be like pillow talk.
Yeah.
Wow.
Should we dim the lights?
Why have we done this all
the time? I don't know. This is a new experience. I like it.
Podcasting in the dark.
Let's try it.
Can we do a new podcast? Three men in a bed. Oh my god!
There we go.
The lights
off. And you know what? We can make this even more cosy.
Oh, what's that?
By putting fire on. So here we are, we're all under the duvets in the nice warm fire, like we're in a country house on a week. You know the holiday? You know the lovely warm cottage that Cameron Diaz goes to? That's where I'm envisaging where we are.
Which one's the holiday?
It's the Christmassy one with Kate Winslet, Jack Black. Jude Law. It's awful.
Is it one of the best Cabin in the Woods films?
I wish it was. If they all annoyed it, I would be happy. Birthdays! Happy birthday! Happy birthday! I've got three birthdays today.
Ooh.
So I thought they all equally deserved a mention. First of all, Ellen Page.
Oh, yeah.
She's been in some geeky properties. I mean, Inception. Super.
Juno. Hard Candy, I mean, like.
Yeah.
She's Shadowcat in X-Men.
And also she was in, is it Two Dark Souls or something? The game last
year. The one with Willem Dafoe as well.
I can't remember what it was called.
I like her as an actress. She's very likeable and very different from most of the peroxide blondes who end up in Hollywood. Also, Alan Rickman.
Mr. Potter.
What's your favourite Rickman performance?
Hans Gruber's up there.
Hans Gruber's
Snape is up there, whether we like to admit it or not.
He's an element of Harry Potter I like, actually. He's very theatrical. Love Actually.
He's got to be Love Actually.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
He's like, I'll get you that jewellery. Will you hurry up, Rowan Atkinson Potter?
Hurry up, Mr. Bean.
Get done for having an affair without doing anything.
And the lady with a very, very strange face.
Yeah, she's not. Emma Thompson's hot.
I would go with Emma Thompson.
I would genuinely go for Emma Thompson.
On Emma Thompson, I watched Stranger Than Fiction.
I was about to say that, yeah.
Good film.
Really good film.
Great film.
Strangely good film.
Wasn't a fan of Emma Thompson until that film.
Yeah, I like her actually. I find her quite charismatic. But yeah, she's very good in that film. In fact, there should be a blog on the website that I've written about comedy actors doing very straight turns in films. I've chose Will Ferrell from Stranger Than Fiction, Steve Carell from Little Miss Sunshine, and Eternal Sunshine with Jim Carrey.
That's still a comedy.
It's a comedy, but he plays the role, so he's more of a straight. I mean, you could argue that elements are Stranger Than Fiction.
I know what you mean.
But I think playing those straight roles and not having to fall back on wacky improv is good.
So
all three of them prove, as written in my book. Eternal Sunshine, Jim Carrey.
I was about to say Jim. Sorry. Yeah, Jim Carrey.
Mm. Then he also has a couple in his bank, but some of them show
the
flashes of goof.
Truman Show's a serious film, though, really.
But he does.
There's that bit in the car, has a little mini breakdown, and he turns into Ace Ventura for 10 minutes. not even 10 minutes, about 30 seconds, but it feels like a bit of a letdown. But it's a very good film. Yeah, and the third birthday is C-3PO, the biggest cunt in the list, but he's our, he is one of the biggest properties of Star Wars, I suppose.
Yes. Do you know he knows 3 billion languages? He never mentions it.
Does he know?
No, he's quite humble.
No.
Yeah. He loved it when those little teddy bears were hoisted him up.
Yeah, finally I can choke one of them. One. One of his languages.
Yeah, it's the shiny robot which slags everyone off through the hole.
With all these prequels, you never know. It's a precursor to here. I know this many languages, there'll be billions of new planets in the new film.
I can't remember, is it 3 million?
Six million.
Is it?
6 million.
I can't remember.
I think it is six.
He never mentions it. So how are we supposed to
know? He needs to be more...
He really needs to put his qualities out there on Front Street.
Yeah.
We've got a exciting show lined up for you today. We've got Comic Conference with Mark coming up later on. We have got... we'll be talking Terminator, and Scott is bringing an In Defence of... Now, we normally do a section called Show and Tell, but we... Me and Scott were talking and we thought we'd rebrand it.
Well, what that's what we do, we're marketing guys.
Oh, I like it.
We're the marketing department.
I like it.
We're calling it more of an open forum. So call it what it is. It's the open forum. We bring anything we like to the table.
All just a more fitting title, I think.
Okay.
I'm just going to have to ask you, Scott, to...
Oh, no. We're supposed to bring something.
Ah.
See, I'm marketing, I'm not content. Yeah. We've all got roles.
Grab a book off the shelf, quick. I brought this.
I don't know, get to Steve while I think.
I'm just going to have to go. Who am I doing an impression of there?
I don't know.
I'm just going to have to ask you to come in on Saturday. Oh, and yeah, I'm going to have to ask you to come in on Sunday too.
Oh...
Rings a bell.
There's another impression from the film I took out.
Office Space.
Yeah. Nice. It's a cracking film. I watched it the other day. I watched it when I was about 14. Didn't really leave an impression on me. I have worked in the office environment. It's such a good film. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I feel so sorry for that guy.
He's a great actor, Abe. He just turns up in all sorts.
He gets pushed away and taken to the edge, and he keeps going, if he makes me move my desk one more time, I'm going to lose it. And then he gets moved and he doesn't lose it.
Maybe
he takes my staple at the, and then at the end he's, it's such a good character.
I can't remember his name, but I first knew him from News Radio, and then he just seems to be in everything. He's got a good part in Boardwalk Empire and stuff, and...
I like the guy is what the guy I was doing an impression of was the boss character who's slimy cock. He's like, yeah, I'm just gonna. You didn't come into work today, and he just starts everything. He's got like a cup of coffee. And we're just gonna have to. It's just a slime.
Oh, is that the meme? If you could just do something, that'd be great. Okay, right.
Yeah, it's a really good film. Anyway, that was my show and tell. Steve, what have you got?
We've spoken about it a lot on the podcast, and I've never really. Spooky ghost.
Careful what you say now, Steve. I know. Someone's mad.
I've offended them.
Archie J, I don't know if you know, I left it in the podcast, but we were talking about something. And it was ghost related, and a noise happened.
Yeah, over there.
And Steve's face was just amazing because it was like he was actually a ghost because he looked across suddenly and then looked at me with this worried expression. He was so sweet.
Like, Andrew, what's that name?
There's a demon.
Because
I think you said the word demon and a noise happened, and you were like, anyway, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no. So we spoke about it on the podcast. We've mentioned it quite a lot of times, and I know you guys have big love for it. Pokemon, I mentioned a while ago I was going to buy a 3DS. I did, and I bought Pokemon X. I'm slightly addicted. I preferred the box.
You like the stag and not the demon, flying demon.
Yeah, I went for the stag.
We're different people, Steve.
I know. Two hearts moving in just now. It's just a join in.
We're different people, Steve.
But I bought Pokemon X and I am slightly addicted. It's brilliant. I mean, I know you guys said the other ones were good, but this one's by far the sort of better one because of all the stuff they've done, and I want to catch all of them. And every time a new one appears or a trainer uses a different one, I go, I want one of those, where can I find that, I want that one. And I'm just addicted. It's brilliant, but it reminds me of sort of the old Zelda games. So you're top down, running around, just pressing on everyone and going, "Hi, oh hello, you've come to my village." Everyone's stood in their houses, really still, and you just go up and stand right in their face.
Yeah, they don't mind.
You've they don't mind.
Broken in.
They don't mind. You're all right.
There's been a thing like in Pokemon, you can go in and check bins and steal from people's houses, and nobody's bothered.
Well, there's a running joke in this that you come across this guy that goes, "There's lots of empty bins around this town. Lots of them, I tell you," and runs off. And there are. You just find them. The bin is empty. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I want one to be full. You have to check all of them just in case.
You've got to check everything. Yeah. Pokemon, I like it when you get the item finder. It makes the whole thing.
But
tell us who's in your team at the moment. Who are some notable Pokemon you've got?
Because you've been learning, haven't you?
I've got the, but I can't remember what it evolved to. It's the start of fire Pokemon that evolves into
Venikin.
Yeah, that evolves into
the one that looks like a fox standing in a wood.
The standing up Pokemon. I never have the Machokes and the Machamps. I find them weird. And now there seems to be an outstanding at Pokemon. Mm. And this one that's a fox with hairy ears stood up.
It is really odd.
It looks nightmarish.
It looks like the sage of a forest. Like wandering through a forest.
Yeah, and one of the moves we've got is Psybeam. And it's like... it's really weird.
Mm.
I pick Froakie. I'm all about ninja frogs.
Okay.
I found the other one, the Conker Bonker thing.
Quilladin. Is it Quilladin?
Not sure.
I'm going to call it Quilladin.
Well, he's got a kind of goofy starter, then he evolves into something completely rubbish, but I do like the end product.
He becomes a tank, like, it looks like a chestnut, I think it's called.
Nice.
He looks bloody cool.
They're all easy to get, no matter who you pick, anyway.
Mm. I'm struggling to catch some of them.
Oh, is he? Get up.
I need to get some tips.
Use your online player. I can give you some.
I need to get some tips off you, yeah. So I've got Fennekin that's evolved into the other bear.
The ultimate thingy. One's Delphox. I can't remember
One with the bracket. Yeah, Pikachu, Jigglypuff. I've gone old school.
You've called your Pikachu Steve as well.
Yeah,
have you?
Yeah,
you've called it yourself.
Yeah.
What's your trainer called?
Harley. She's a girl.
Why? Why?
She's called Harley.
But I always assume people, when you can change your avatar, you make it you.
I've forgotten what they call them. Guys who always choose women characters to play as.
God!
My name's Steve and I'm weird then.
There is a Japanese term for a guy who always uses a woman in games. I don't know what it's called.
I can't remember.
Nancy.
It's
a big Jesse.
Is it a big pansy?
Taking my scarf off because I'm too hot.
Big girl's blouse.
Shut up.
It's fine. It's
I just played as a girl, just cause.
Fair enough. Why if not? You want to explore being a different gender in video games,
that's what Pokemon's about.
That's what games are about. Escapism from the real world. But go on. No,
Any other standout Pokemon you've got?
I've got Squirtle.
Like Squirtle, big fan.
There's a really weird one that looks like a cool alien with pointy ears. I can't remember what it's called.
Alien with
Zapod or something weird.
Zapod.
It's a really weird one, but it's really hard. I like it. Took me ages to destroy it, so once I caught it, I was like, right, and I'm using it now, and it's like, that's the sort of standout one.
Are you getting your head around all the different types?
I'm getting there, but you guys have got the knowledge. I'm going, what's that one? I don't understand. So I'm just catching.
It's like first days.
Catching everything and collecting anything and going, I don't even know what's happening.
Do you get excited when they evolve?
Yeah. You get the little screen and the animation that says, such as evolved, and it's like, oh. Yeah, I am. It's a game I'm going to plow hours into, I can tell. I already know. It's like Final Fantasy meets Zelda meets. It's just.
Well, I'm a bit jealous because, like, you know, I played the first generation Red and Blue, so I'll never feel that new discovering Pokemon for the first time feeling. The closest thing I get is the new games and how cool they are in relation.
But you also, when you're an established fan, you approach it differently in terms of you will look up the Pokemon. You will learn it as you go and things. Yeah. And, whereas if you're brand new, it is like walking into a forest of new
and
beasts.
You know how it works, yeah. If you know what I mean. Like, I know the types and stuff. So you, and just by looking, you can make an educated guess. Mm. And you know what you're doing. Whereas Steve's going in cold.
I'm getting that feeling of like when I first played Final Fantasy VII and you're running around, suddenly it goes, and the battle music kicks and you go, what's it going to be this time? And I'm getting that, and then the shadow appears and it's like, it's a, what's that? Right, I want it. Lobbing Pokeballs at it. Right, no, I need to paralyse it. I need to whatever. And it's like...
Do you understand the concept of typing, the different Pokemon types?
Yeah. There's Earth, Fire, Water, Rock, Air.
Everything's got two or three weaknesses and two or three strengths.
But yeah, I thought thoroughly enjoying that. So that's my...
Cool. My leads on a bit, because I watched Pokemon Origins, which I thought was cracking. Absolutely brilliant. And then I thought, well, how does this compare to the first movie? So I watched the first movie again.
I saw it not long ago. It doesn't.
It doesn't, no. I really like the opening, though, where Mew's like, I've been created as a Pokemon, and then it starts questioning the relationship between a Pokemon and a human, and why it is that way around, and, well, surely I can be.
Hmm.
And there's that really good opening. And then it's Ash skips in and goes, with his fucking stupid Pokemon. Now, he's a new thing that's annoyed me about Ash, is why he doesn't evolve his Pokemon. Is it because shiny little happy Squirtles sell merchandise?
Yeah.
It's really annoying. A true trainer would push their Pokemon to grow.
In fairness, though, his only successful evolution when he gets Charizard don't work out for him much. So
it's because he's a terrible trainer.
Mm.
And Brock and Misty just seem to walk around behind him going,
Oh Ash,
you dick! But the comparison between Origins and the first movie is really shows how Pokemon's developed into something. But going back to its original property, but showing it as something a lot more grown up.
When was the first movie? Was it 2000?
Around about that, 1999, 2000. And then all the Pokemon's tears bring him back to life. They should just not bothered.
Well, it's out there. It's the anime is a lot like that, though. It's an acquired taste.
Something I also really enjoyed from Origins is none of the Pokemon said their name.
No.
Right. They all just were like creatures that made noises, whereas in this one, they're all running around. Pika, 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 pika!
Well, I like it because it was an animation adaptation of the game, not the anime. So it went like, we've got to make him cutesy, and it's got to be Ash, and it's got to be this new story.
I know, it was kind of nice
to the game
to see, like Brock as not a dribbling pervert, as a guy who actually really helps and things, and it just changed the characters.
Fun fact, the guy who voiced Brock in Pokemon Origins was the second Black Power Ranger.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah.
Don't ask me how I found that information. I tell you, I just live on IMDb sometimes looking
at useless facts.
Finding the most stupid, useless.
Researching the next Hall of Fame. Who can I find?
I was watching Power Rangers, and then I looked up like when the Black Ranger changed. And then found the new one.
Just running my hand in the
air. It's a celebration. and then went, oh, he's done Pokemon Origins. I wonder who it was, Brock. That's that story.
That's cool. I actually started off going, wow, there's like 16 Pokemon movies now. I'm going to watch them all, Pokemon.
There's more than that, I think.
I know, there is. There's loads, isn't there? And I thought after watching the first one, I was like, no.
When's Origins from, then, out of interest?
About November.
Okay.
It's the latest, basically, Pokemon animation. Hopefully it means they're going to move into a new...
Yeah, it's a special one-off four-part. You can combine it to film, but it's like a four-part series based on the old Red and Blue games.
Right.
It was just a great, nostalgic revisit.
Quite heartfelt at times. There's a little Cubone story that... Yeah. Broke my heart.
In Lavender Town.
And that the Team Rocket were given the time of day that they deserve. They're not bumbling idiots either.
No, they're bad dudes.
Horrible. Kill Pokemon and things.
Oh.
And Blue wasn't the bad guy necessarily.
No, I like that he was an honourable kind of
like,
rival.
Smell you later.
He did say it though. I liked it. He did get it in there.
He did do a little.
Yes. Yeah.
That's Blue.
Yeah. But he pushed, like we're talking about Rush really, he pushed his opponent to become the best.
To be the very best that no one ever was. To catch them is my real test. To train them is my cause.
Pokemon, gonna catch them all. Pokemon, I know it's my destiny.
Oh, you're my best friend. In a world we must defend.
Pokemon, Pokemon.
That's the most fucking...
This is the most...
power ballady kids show ending I think I've ever witnessed.
And then there was the poker rap.
Yeah. Charmeleon, water till, Mewtwo, tentacle, aerodactyl, armonite, slow poke, pigeon, arbok. That's all, folks. Catch him, gotta catch him all. Gotta catch him all. Pokemon.
This is the most surreal moment because we're all under a duvet. Scott's face is lit by this heater. He's wrapping Pokemon at me with his arm around me. I'm terrified.
I think it was college humour. Might not be. Did where they did all 718 Pokemon in a Pokemap that lasts 10 minutes.
Whoa!
And it's really funny and just relentless. It's funny and it's also an endurance test. I recommend it.
Cool. Well, Scott, have you thought up a show and tell? An open discussion forum.
I finally watched Kick-Ass 2.
How did you feel?
Cue Kevin McAllister impression.
Why are hands on the face?
We were both like, I'm still torn to whether I don't like it or it was an acceptable follow on. But you've not read the graphic novel, so I'm interested to hear.
I've not read the graphic novel. Mm-hmm. I really liked the first one. Mm-hmm. Read the first graphic novel. Didn't like it much.
Oh.
At all.
Okay.
But meh.
It's really neutered.
I mean, I had a couple of laughs just at the harshness of, like, we're called toxic mega cunts and shit like that. It's just a bit random and harsh, so you just giggle. And, you know, they pushed the boundary a bit with super villain violence and shit. But I just watched it and it just felt like this soulless, trying to be cool, bloody, unremorseful. Like, the first Kick-Ass, it's a superhero comedy that's a bit removed. I know the message is like at times is like that this is real because it's meant to be quote unquote real life, isn't it? But it's a bit removed and funny and out there. The second one just seems a bit gratuitous and a bit ploddy and a bit, and it's not nearly funny or original or interesting anymore. It's just weird. I didn't like it.
The graphic novel does go kind of a much darker route, but it wasn't really reflected in the the film. Most of the story is generally in that direction. Hit Girl has a completely different storyline. What did you think to Hit Girl's story in that?
I liked it when she tried to walk away from being Hit Girl, and I liked her trying to be normal stuff. And then they ruin it with like cattle prods or whatever she uses, just more gratuitous, pointless, stupid. It's just a lot like that where it's like, oh, this is interesting, and then it's over too quick, and it's got a crap gratuitous payoff, and then I didn't feel it, and I get a six, but I don't see the
That's
point of the film.
It's interesting.
It just seems like such a wasted revisit of nothing, like.
Just to return to the world as opposed to development.
Yeah, there's nothing happening. There's no point to returning, it feels like, other than... Yeah,
it is going to be interesting because, obviously, the second graphic novel, completely different ending. Because they've left out all the gratuity. But, obviously, the third one's out now. The comics have started coming out, so it's going to be interesting to see how they handle the third film because there's no way... It's going to follow directly on, like the first two films. They can't. They actually cannot.
Well, I do remember Mark Miller saying when he was doing his hype machine for Kick-Ass 2, like, this is when it blows up, and then we're coming back with a third one. And I watched it, and this isn't blown up. This is bloated. It's pointless. I'm not interested in a third one now.
I really enjoyed the graphic novel, I'll be honest.
I did.
I didn't overly enjoy the film, but I thought it was fine. I'd be very interested to see what you think of the graphic novel now.
Maybe.
But
like I said, I didn't like spit blood and get angry. It's watchable. It's a six, but I liked the first Kick-Ass, and I wanted it to be good, and it just wasn't.
Just
wasn't. It just wasn't good.
That's interesting.
Lots of people have watched it since, and lots of three-word reviews and things of people. This generally seems to be the opinion that it just seems immensely pointless.
It does. I've heard no one slag it off or say it's horrible, because I think people enjoy Kick-Ass and they want me to like it, and it's watchable, but it's a pointless.
I think the motherfucker's one of the really strong characters. He steps up and it's quite an interesting to a point. It's kind of the beginning bit when he's his origins.
Well, it's his film, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess. But
I quite like that. It gets stupid towards
the
end.
I like it in concept. They don't execute it that well, I don't think.
Which is why I think, I mean, I know you put him forward to be one of the best actors in our award.
Yeah, I thought he was good.
I didn't. I wasn't big on him, to be honest. That whole thing. Mediocre.
Oh, but it's not Kick-Ass.
No.
Flat ass.
It's tap ass.
A few weeks ago, on this fine podcast, you did it in defence of running zombies.
Speedy buggers.
Aye.
The fast biters. And it was my turn. So, and I won't lie, I weren't sure what I should defend, because I feel like I'm always defending shit. Like Bat Fleck and Eisenbergs, and that's about it, actually. It's just Batman stuff. So like, all I do is defend Batman stuff, so like, I'll defend Batman stuff. So yeah. My in defence of is my favourite Batman film that is the most maligned. My favourite of the most maligned, should I say. Because Batman and Robin's the best one. Is Batman Returns, which I think's a good film. But it's quite maligned in the Batman community. And I know Andrew likes it as well. So I thought, and I assume Steve's seen it, that I thought we could defend Batman Returns.
Ah, okay.
Nice, okay.
So it's Burton's second Batman outing.
Yeah.
He struck it very dark and gothic in the first. He went a little goofier in the second outing, would you say?
It's weird, because it gets more matchbox and operatic and darker, but you're right, it's like there's a cartoon gothicness in there. It goes goofier, but it's also more macabre at the same time.
Yeah.
It's so much more Burtony than the first one, which is exactly why I think it's better.
I seem to think now that there's old Burton and new Burton, and the new Burton is not as dark as the old Burton. It pretends to be dark. It covers itself in a shroud of dark, you know, but it isn't as dark.
It's 14-year-old emo dark.
It is. Yeah. Whereas before, when you had Beetlejuice, you had Edward Scissorhands, you had these Batman movies, they were sad and dark. Mm. They were emotional and dark. And they were dark. They weren't pretense dark. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I like this one because it is goofy. There are silly moments, but there is a sense of darkness throughout. And I still stand by and say it's my favourite Batman film. I know there's gold out there now with the Nolan ones, but it was my Batman film, and it's the one that left the biggest effect on me.
It's the Penguin one, right? Well, I'm mulling it over in my head.
It's the one I most watched as a kid. It was my until Nolan bounced along. The first two Burton Batmans and Mask of the Phantasm were all I had, the cinematic Batmans. So I can never hate this film. I can never not defend. But I think it's a lot better than people give credit for.
What is the general reception then? Because I don't really know.
It's seen as, for a start, Batman is a bit psychopathic, quote unquote, because like he blows up the strong man, sets fire to that devil with his Batmobile. And then he has the cheek to rip his mask off at the end and say, "We're not above the law." And then everyone cites Zombie Catwoman as the caller and the freak show that's the Penguin.
Mm.
And my defence is the mob boss Penguin, the modern day Penguin as we know it, was not invented in the comics when this film came out. It was just the old gimmicky umbrella
wah, wah, wah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And he came up with a new spin, and I like Danny DeVito's Penguin. Mm. I think it's really good. I think it's as strong as Jack Nicholson's Joker. And I think Catwoman's quote-unquote death is more of a metaphor.
Mm.
That people refuse to even think of that possibility. Go, oh no, she's a zombie.
Yeah.
Zombie revived by cats. It makes no sense. I went, I know it doesn't, because it's a fucking metaphor.
Mm.
Bastard.
I think I really like Danny DeVito's Penguin because he, like in Edward Scissorhands, he's a sad individual. He's had a horrible life. He got thrown in the sewers by his parents because they thought he was ugly and disgusting. Yeah.
And he's a pervert, which I weirdly like.
I
weirdly like deformed perverts going, oh, there's your button. It's creepy. Yeah. I like a good creepy.
That was creepy. I don't remember.
I like it when he's chasing Catwoman around, getting yeah. all aroused.
Oh, you tease! It gets quite angry.
It's. Yeah, he is a weird, but he does. There is a sadness to when he starts, and he plays on that to become elected or whatever it is, becomes yeah. mayor, and then he's just a weirdo come the end of it.
And there's a great theme of duality, animal duality in Catwoman, Penguin, and Batman, and Burton Batman films always get accused of being more about the villains than the than Batman, but this film is really balanced and thematically strong and. Very German expressionistic, and I, for what it is and not for what it's not, which is people focus on what it isn't, because it's not the perfect Batman adaptation at all, and it, all the rest. But I love, for an Elseworlds single sort of auteur's take on Batman, I think it's really cool.
But you could argue that he set up Schumacher. For the worlds that Schumacher made it. He put it by the edge of the paint cans and then Schumacher threw it in there and made it all brightly coloured and neon. But that's Schumacher's fault. That can't be Tim Burton's fault because Tim had left at that point.
A lot of my favourite Batman moments before Nolan came along are in Batman Returns. Then. Like when the wings appear when he jumps off the building. It was so cool when you were a kid. Even now, I kind of I get like a little bat moment when it happens.
For me, it is the Batmobile as well. That long, Batmobile, that completely impractical car, but it was so cool. And it just I mean Nolan's is great because it's in a real world, but that doesn't feel like still doesn't feel like a Batmobile to me because I always have that vision in my head of that cool. Cool car.
Well, his Batpod's more iconic than his Tumbler, isn't it? In Batman's. But like, I like Nolan's for being more reverent and filtered with the realistic filter, and the far more definitive from a Batman fan's perspective. But seeing as we've got them now, so you don't have to bitch and moan that your Batman's not being done right, quote unquote. I think we should go back and appreciate the older takes because that's not. I understand when that's all you get, so you get frustrated because you want it to be better or different because that's all you had. But we've had so many different versions of Batman now that surely we can appreciate them all for what they are and not what they're not anymore. So can people go back and realise Batman Returns isn't that bad and shut up?
Yeah. Stop moaning about Batfleck and what might be in 2 years' time and just appreciate what we have.
Also, if you read some of the graphic novels, especially some of the Deeney ones, the detective ones that he did about 10, 15 years ago, there's a very dark Gotham with a bright twist, if you see what I mean by that.
Yeah.
If you read his detective shorts, I mean, that world, that side of Batman, that gothic, that extreme gothic side. I also think that the first Arkham game, Arkham Asylum, is almost... a Tim Burton Batman one. Not later on, they got a bit grittier, but in that one, the bright, the big buildings, the ivy covering them, the villains were very kind of, not Burton-y, but they were set in a gothic world. And for me, Batman is set in a gothic surrounding.
Batman is incredibly, as a character, it's conceit and definitely his villainy. Is incredibly theatrical.
Now, people are ashamed of that word or scared of that because, you know, that can so easily be camp.
Yeah.
But, and Nolan found a good way to filter it, realistically speaking, to evoke the theatricality. But I, like what Andrew was just saying, like when you play the Arkham Asylum games and stuff, they get all the grittiness and dark and noir colours right, but that just makes the theatricality of the villains even better.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. They're aesthetically dyed to their surroundings, and I like that about Burton's. They're incredibly theatrical, but that's Burton's Batman. That's Batman filtered through Tim Burton's brain, and I love it for that. Just like The Dark Knight's Batman through Nolan's brain, and I want Batman to be through Zack Snyder's brain. And do you know what I mean?
How do you think people would have seen it if we'd had Nolan's first and then Nolan?
I think they'd hate it.
Yeah.
But it's also very much a sign of the times. Batman has always reflected the times, graphic novels to films. If you look at the TV series, it was very 60s.
Yeah.
If you look at Batman 89, it's very 80s. Yeah. You look at this one in 92, you can see reflections of how the films were then. And then as you got towards the late 90s, films in general were going that way in the bright coloredness. And then we had a 5-6 years hiatus. When we were back again, we had a changed world. We were post 9/11. Films had changed. They were less like that. They were more earthed. They were more real. They were more gritty. And that's when the Nolan ones were bred. I think we see our society and culture reflected in the movies of the time. I think in Batman films, you can definitely see that.
Well, yeah, because it's definitely historically linked. Like, you couldn't have Batman 89 until The Dark Knight Returns and all the sort of dark series reimaginings in the comics happened in the 80s. And without Michael Uslan running about desperately finding someone to take Batman serious and so on and so on, Batman 89 wouldn't have happened. And if that doesn't happen, you definitely don't get Nolan later on. And without Burton's being successful, going too far, Schumacher taking it over, ruining it, you don't get to Nolan. You just don't. It's very causal. So I know what you mean by over around, and I think they would hate it, but Nolan wouldn't have happened at all.
Yeah.
And Burton wouldn't have done it. Yeah. Burton wouldn't have done it in that way, probably, now, if he did it again, after, especially after Nolan. But that's why I like these films, because that is... There's no manual. There were no manual for a Batman film then. He just did his version of Batman.
Yeah.
And that's what it were. And people hated it because it's not their version of Batman. But we're 7 films on, waiting for the 8th since then. Do you know what I mean? Like... I got my maths wrong there. We're 5 films on. We're 6 on the way, sorry. Like, you know, I've got a lot of time for Batman Returns. I just do. It's goofy. There's penguins with rockets. It's not perfect.
Yeah, the penguins are good.
But it's still good, man. The amount of people who are, like, a bit derisive of it and then seem okay with Batman Forever is a lot higher than you think, and that upsets me more than anything. Because Batman Forever I hate more than Batman and Robin.
I probably agree. I get fed up of... I'd rather sit and snort my way through Ice to You and so forth
than
two idiots in Tommy Lee Jones and Jim Carrey just going in my face, which is practically what happens every time they're on screen, and it's fucking irritating. Whereas at least we get some bad puns, you know?
But Batman Forever's not as bad as Batman and Robin. But it's more frustrating because in Batman Forever, you half see the potential slight inkling that this maybe might have been okay if they hadn't have done all this stupid shit. Whereas Batman and Robin, that was never going to be anything other than terrible. So in a weird way, it goes full circle. And you can let it wash over you and go, oh God, how bad's this? Whereas Batman Forever, I watch every time going, why didn't they swap the Riddler and Two-Face's roles in the film? Why are all the guns thing? Why is Batman smiling? What's the point of Chase Meridian? Do you know what I mean? I just get really angry.
No.
Why are they cackling? Why is Two-Face the Joker? And it just goes on and on. So I just wanted to defend Batman Returns. What do you guys... Do you think it needs to be defended? Do you think it's got its place? Do you think it's good?
I think any knowing Batman fan will appreciate what it is. I have spoken to a lot of people who do get their Batmans confused back when, and they pit them all into a pile and they go, oh, rubbish, that one. Was that the one with Jim Carrey? No. Oh. And they get them all tied up into one thing, and I think it's a shame that Returns gets bundled in with those two, as opposed to sticking it with 89.
Yeah.
Any knowing Batman fan knows that there is two, and there's two, and there's three in terms of the structure.
Well, the connective tissue of Michael Goff's Alfred and Pat Hingle being Commissioner Gordon heavily implied there's four sequels to each other, and they kind of wanted to do the Bond thing going, it's a sequel, but we're not really acknowledging any of the other films.
Right.
And we can recast without ever questioning it. But, like you say, it's two, three. Mm. It's not, they're not connected. They can't be. Because Gotham doesn't build giant homoerotic Greek statues over 2 years. Yeah. The Gothams are completely different. And I love the Burton ones. Don't tell him with the Schumacher one. Anyway, what do you think?
I mean, I like Batman 89, I remember. I loved Batman 89. I remember collecting all the cards. I used to collect the movie cards, and you'd build up the picture of the Joker and Batman, and I played the game. And so that was sort of my... Other than the 60s Batman, that was my sort of introduction to Batman. I did like the second one. I thought Penguin was good. I liked Danny DeVito. The Jim Carrey one, like you said, Jim Carrey was very, oh, look, I'm wacky and everything. And it's like... There he is again, right?
His haircut changes in every scene in the film.
I just, it was every an odd one.
Every single scene, his hair changes. even when the scene's meant to be like almost straight after. It's almost funny to think about.
Batman and Robin, I don't really remember. I don't know if I've seen it all. But yeah, I think it's good. I like the first two. I do remember the first two. And very iconic. Like, it's a very of their time, but very, very iconic because of that fact. And I don't know if it needs defending. It's a good, solid Batman film.
Symbol that is still the one people wear on the t-shirts.
On the belt buckles.
That theme still evokes Batman. That Batmobile is still seen, well, it's not seen in the definitive Batmobile, but you see it and you go, that's the Batmobile. And he just got the theatricality and the operatic and the iconic elements of Batman right. Whether you reckon he got the characters and content right, it's debatable.
Also, but not knowing as much as you guys, it seems to draw from the darkness of the graphic novels and the early comics, and takes the 60s campness, and like you've said, I'm just summing it up in my own head, but to merges that together.
It almost does well. The perfect balance of that, actually.
It's kind of that, like...
Especially Batman 89.
Because when you were discussing Robin and all the graphic novels down there, some of them are really, really dark, and it seems to sort of take elements of all of that and go, let's be a bit camp and silly, but...
And was it Cesar Romero played
Joker?
Yeah,
60s.
Yeah.
You can see that in Jack Nicholson's get-up, almost. Mm. And it's an evolution that through, even from the 60s one, there's an evolution to 89, because everyone, when they thought Batman at that point, thought the 60s one, and it kind of evolved a lot, but there is elements you can see.
He took that look and he made it.
Yeah, and then, maybe the meeting of camp and gothic perhaps was at its most perfectly balanced in Returns, and then got too camp again.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, everyone heralded 89 because it was finally Batman's being taken serious. But you watch him now, especially after Nolan's, and they're still really theatrical because Nolan's are so earnest, they're so sincere. He tries his hardest to make it as real as possible and serious as possible, which I love. So they don't seem as serious almost as the ones. But they're that perfect middle ground, because I like it being a bit... I like Batman to be theatrical.
And they're massively quotable.
It's a big strength of Batman.
And on a final point on Batman Returns, I mean, I know you like your Anne Hathaway, but whoa! Pfeiffer, she's my Catwoman. How much Vaseline did she have to put on to squeeze into that suit?
That dominatrix
vacuum packed into it.
I love...
It's nice.
when she like catapults out of the building and just says meow. You know, that's just good shit.
She's sexy as oot.
She's sexy as oot.
So yeah, I
Christopher Walken as well, we should.
Oh yeah, Walken. Oh, you can't beat a bit of Walken.
Who's a completely original villain, named after obviously the Nosferatu actor. Great villain as well. Completely made up. Tim Burton made him up.
And he worked. He didn't seem out of place.
It didn't at all. He's one of the best things about the film.
He's a grounded villain with these two completely ungrounded villains in a way. He's the boy holding the balloons that are floating up there in that sense. You know, he's, and that creates a really good, brings it back to Earth.
And that, and the, like I said, I touched on duality earlier. The film's about masks as well, and he's the one who can step into the light. He's not the Batman. He's not Catwoman. He's not a deformed penguin. But he's the most fucking evil in that entire. Mm. He's the hot. He's the only absolute, and he's a bastard. Yeah. Film's got, he's very rich in themes. It's got, it's denser than people get credit for, because it's light and plot.
Mm.
But yeah.
And penguins are fireworks people.
Penguins. Yeah, what more do he's
what's
like?
Wrong with you?
He's got a powerized fucking duck in a sewer. What do people want? Mm. Like, that's what I want.
He's got a mini Batmobile that he puts a quarter into and goes hee hee hee.
I know, why are people complaining?
I know.
Stop complaining.
And we've done our part at Weekly Geek Speak as well, because we did employ the penguins in the Hall of Fame, so they weren't out of work after.
I will say this though, the work, there is a bad part of the film. It's not perfect. It's when he puts that CD in and tries to DJ it, because that doesn't even make sense. Yeah. It doesn't even work.
But it was topped by the Batman Forever credit card in Batman and Robin. And on that almighty low, we will end this section.
Hi, it's time for Comic Conference. We're joined by Mark. It's been a while, Mark. How are you?
Yeah, hi. It has been. A little bit kind of tied up this time last month, unfortunately, but all sorted now. So continuing what we were talking about over Christmas, I guess, really, to a certain degree.
Yeah, all good. So first thing you're going to talk to us about, you've got Sandman Overture. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that then, please?
Well, I decided to kind of look at two books that are kind of in progress now, but are both kind of leading into this start of this new year that I'm looking forward to. Both which are kind of mature reading, but we'll say adult in the kind of intellectual, slightly kind of way, rather than the violence and boobs.
Okay.
So if you're just looking for violence and boobs, sorry. And the two books that I've kind of chosen to look at are the Sandman Overture by Neil Gaiman and J.H. Williams III, and Marvel Comics over the other side are reprinting Alan Moore and Gary Leach's run on Miracle Man, or Marvel Man as it was.
Okay.
Yeah. So in both cases, as I say, they are kind of mature market books, but they're both coming out, the big two, in a way that you would not normally expect to a certain degree. I'll start with the Sandman, and I'll give you a bit of kind of a... Have you read the Sandman at all before?
I have. I remember the Sandman, from years ago, getting out of our local library. And fantastic book.
Along with kind of books like the Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, The Invisibles by Grant Morrison, and Hellblazer, the John Constantine book, that was kind of... They've kind of been put together over so many years in different trade paperbacks for DC Vertigo Comics. They effectively are the linchpins of Vertigo Comics. But the Sandman itself actually started in 1989. It started before Vertigo Comics came into being, starting with Gaiman writing, Sam Keith and Mike Dringenberg doing the artwork for that. Mm. Although, to be honest, there were so many kind of artists that were involved with the Sandman over the kind of the 75 issues that it was going. I think one of the only real constants along the way were Gaiman writing and Dave McKean doing the covers. But the series itself is about Morpheus, or Dream, as he's usually referred to, the Lord of Dreams. And Morpheus resides in a realm within the kind of the DC sphere of things called the Dreaming, which is kind of a dreamscope where any person who happens to be sleeping goes to the Dreaming. They're all connected.
Okay.
So it allows the characters to kind of move in between different people's minds and spaces while they dream. Morpheus himself kind of bears a bit of resemblance to Robert Smith of The Cure.
Yes, he does.
usually wearing black cloaks and a gown of some kind.
And the sort of large hair.
Yes, exactly. Kind of just sticking up there. But the story kind of began back in the 90s with a group of occultists who were trying to capture the Angel of Death with a ritual, hoping to force the Angel of Death to grant them immortality. But instead of acquiring Death, they captured Dream, Death's brother.
Right.
Death, as you may have seen in other DC comics, is portrayed as this young goth girl who wears an Egyptian anchor single around her neck and sports like an Eye of Horus tattoo over one of her eyes. She's always very relaxed and kind of shepherds people onto the afterlife, kind of breaking that news gently to them they've actually died. And that was really kind of the starting point of what made the Sandman a fascinating series, because Death and Dream are part of this one big family known as the Endless, which features Despair. We had Desire, who was sometimes male, sometimes female, sometimes both or neither. Okay. Delirium, who was formerly Delight. And Destiny, who was blind, and he had this big book chained to his arm, which has the stories of every life, of every being in history, from the start of the universe to the end, written into it. But he himself is the only one who's able to read it, even though he's blind.
Nice! So
you get the idea. Yeah. It's fine. Oh, and they have the estranged brother Destruction as well, who we don't talk about.
The unspeakable one.
So, yeah, this is what kind of hooked people into the Sandman. Then it was really these kind of characters. They were it was a very intelligent stories. Again, we say adult stories, but not in a sex and violence kind of way. Most of the Sandman has been collected over time. I think it's 10 volumes. The main library.
Wow.
And most of those stories kind of began with Dream reclaiming his kingdom, making plans for what might follow after him, and so on. But along the way, you had constantly kind of mixing in with mortal affairs. There was Hope Godling, who was given immortality so they could kind of watch him across history. There was things like the Corinthian trying to uncreate this nightmare creature that Morpheus had created and who had escaped out of the dreaming and into the real world. And we even had the best known story was him giving the inspiration for A Midsummer Night's Dream to William Shakespeare. It's all these little kind of little nice stories in between that actually get remembered the most. But the series itself finished back in 1996, so it's been away for quite a while. Gaiman wrote a series, a straight-to-hardback volume called Endless Nights back in 2003. And over 10 years ago now since he last went with that, and that kind of detailed stories of each of the characters and the family of the Endless. So now, starting with an issue that came, I believe Sandman Overture, the first issue came out in November, if I'm right.
Okay.
With Gaiman writing and J.H. Williams doing the artwork. Now, we've spoken about J.H. Williams a little bit before. I know him mostly from Wildstorm Comics, where he was doing a series called Desolation Jones with Warren Ellis. He's probably best known to most people as the artist most involved with Batwoman at DC, especially since the changeover of the new DC 52. He draws some fantastic kind of a little bit Art Deco styled, painted and inked. Really does great work when he's got like a two-page spread and you have a look at it and you kind of see that, yes, each panel is obviously a panel in its own right and they weave in that kind of narrative, but if you stand back for a second, you see that it's a bigger picture. For example, in the first issue of Overture, there's a scene with the Corinthian, who's best known for the manic grin, and each panel is a panel, but if you stand back, you notice that each panel is also a tooth in the Corinthian's mouth. It's little things like
fantastic.
That. Incredible work. Unfortunately, the series itself has been slightly delayed.
Right.
I believe the next issue is either scheduled for the last week of March, might be the first week of April. A little bit delayed, and the series itself starts, I think, as far as I can tell, weaving into the plot lines and so on, just before the main series itself. So it serves as the overture.
Nice. So has the art style changed much over the course of the years, or is it very much grounded in sort of the Robert Smith look and the thing?
It can change quite a bit depending on who the artist has been. I mean, Chris Piccolo did some issues of Death, for example, for a while, and he has a very specific style, probably best known for his work with the X-Men and so on. But by and large, the same kind of aesthetic is there, but it always has that kind of very, very distinctively independent, very distinctive Vertigo style to it.
Right.
Even when the artist is somebody completely different, the kind of the motifs, the colouring of speech bubbles, the colouring of costumes, you can always tell which character in there is going to be Dream. He has the dark eyes, he has the pale face, and he has the black speech bubbles with the white writing.
Okay. And the other issue you're going to tell us about was Miracle Man, I believe.
Yes, two issues so far at Marvel Comics. Miracle Man. To understand Miracle Man, I'm going to take you quite a long way back.
Right, okay.
Are you aware of the DC Comics character these days, formerly Fawcett Comics a long, long time ago, called Captain Marvel, or as he is these days due to legal reasons with Marvel Comics, Shazam?
Yes, I am indeed.
the basics of Shazam is that this little boy called Billy Batson, orphan guy in his teens, is given this magic word Shazam, which allows him to transfer into the body of an adult superhero.
Nice.
And you had a number of different kinds of spin-off characters from that property. You had Mary Marvel, who was like the female version of Captain Marvel. You had Captain Marvel Jr., who was exactly as that sounds. It became the Marvel family. But we're talking back in, I think, midway through the 1950s, as it started to kind of pick up for Fawcett Comics with this property, DC Comics took them to court, saying effectively, well, this is a character in a cape who can fly, and therefore you're trading off Superman with him.
Right.
And for one reason or another at that point, eventually Fawcett Comics let go of that. They lost legal action, and eventually the character was sold to DC Comics and became part of their universe. But over here in the UK, a guy named Lee Miller had been basically reprinting all of those Fawcett comics for the UK market, as he had been. And so in 1954, rather,
wow,
he ran out of material. So rather than just kind of discontinuing it all, he approached a guy named Mick Anglo, who came up with effectively a way of continuing it as Marvel Man. So Billy Batson becomes Mickey Moran, a little boy who's grown into his teens. He's working as a copy boy at a newspaper. And when he utters the magic word Kimota, which is roughly atomic backwards, he is transformed into Marvel Man. I mean, this is pure 1950s comic silliness at this point. You've got young Marvel Man, who is Dickie Dauntless, and kid Marvel Man, Johnny Bates. Their main enemy is a guy named Young Nasty Man. Young Nasty Man. Nasty Man, all one word. I'm not even kidding. This is a genuine, it's silly stuff. But that ran from the 1950s into, I think it finished in 1963. So it did have a fair run at that, but it was just kind of left as kind of an abandoned British comics property. But if we go forward to 1982, Alan Moore was working for Warrior Comic. Warrior was formed by Des Skin, who used to be the kind of chief guy for Marvel UK in the 1970s. And he launched Warrior Magazine, which featured, it was the first place that V for Vendetta started, actually, the Bo Jeffries saga, and also a new Marvel Man, which was written by Alan Moore and Gary Leach. Gary Leach, probably better known for his work with 2000 AD. This story basically showed us picking up with Marvel Man 30 years kind of later on. It shows us an adult, Michael Moran now, not Mickey Moran, who's married, he's approaching middle age, and at the point where he's reporting on the opening of a nuclear power plant, it kind of gets hijacked by a terrorist group, and suddenly kind of gets this kind of buzzing at the back of his mind, and he realizes all these kind of messed up dreams that he's been having for the past 30 years. Well, they aren't dreams. This was his life. And the little world, he sees a mirror, kind of like a mirrored writing of Atomic Research Center. He sees the word atomic and it becomes Kimota. And he says the word out loud and he becomes Marvel Man. Off, done, transformed again. So, yes, that series ran at Warrior until that kind of folded. And so Alan Moore went to take V for Vendetta over to DC Comics, which where it was finished off and became as we know it now. Yeah. And he took Marvel Man over to Eclipse Comics, who were another American publisher at the time, where they had to change the name to Miracle Man from Marvel Man.
Right.
To kind of appease Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
It was okay and fairly easy for us to kind of get away with that over in the UK. Not going to sit there with the Americans. So, yes, it went there and they continued that for a while. And then Alan Moore and Gary Leach were well kind of away from that. They gave up and passed the rights on to the next guys, who were, surprise, surprise, Neil Gaiman.
Right, okay, so it's kind of...
And by the end of the run, Mark Buckingham. Yeah, and that's where it kind of stayed until 1994 when Eclipse went under. And this is where things start to get complicated.
Right.
And perhaps the reason that this series has kind of been propelled up to this kind of near-legendary status is that after Eclipse went bankrupt, several different parties began to argue over who actually owned the rights to the series. Because Alan Moore had transferred his rights over to Neil Gaiman. But then we had Todd McFarlane of Image Comics started claiming that he owned the rights because he'd then brought all the kind of creative assets for Eclipse Comics when they went bankrupt. He
right.
even started teasing kind of a relaunch of the character in the pages of Spawn. This started to get really, really messy.
Oh, gosh.
You even got some of the artists who were involved with the book when it was over at Warrior Magazine saying that when they reprinted it from Eclipse, they never got paid for the reprints. I've seen Alan Davis, and rightly so, refuse to sign copies of the Eclipse prints because he was never paid for the work.
Fair enough.
We saw that at a convention a few years ago. You know, perfectly within his rights.
Yeah.
So with so many people kind of involved, it was debated as to whether this was ever going to get reprinted or collected again. And it's taken Neil Gaiman, with a little of the backing from Marvel Comics, absolute years of legal hell to get through it, but it has now happened. The first two issues of the Alan Moore, Gary Leach run have been put out with a bit of kind of back history and back manner and another few strips in with it as well. It's a slightly higher price point at Marvel. I think it's a good pound more expensive than the other books, as it were. But the intention is that they're going to reprint all of those right through to Gaiman and Buckingham's run.
Yeah.
And then they're going to finish off the run that they never got to finish with a whole bunch of new material to come to the end of that story. So I guess the question would be, is it worth it? Yes.
It sounds like it. I mean,
we kind of see Watchmen as being this big kind of conclusion of all of what Alan Moore really planned to and ever intended to say about superhero comics. But this, along with his Captain Britain run that he did with Alan Davis as well, these are the really strong precursors of the whole thing. Mm. Again, it's deconstructing superheroes. It's trying to apply that kind of ludicrous four-color hero logic into a real-world setting.
Yeah.
And when you do that, showing exactly how kind of messed up that can be when you take these things as absolute written fact.
Yeah.
The series has, there's some truly spectacular body counts in parts of this. Right from the off of the series, it kind of shows us that just because the Miracle Man family, as it were, had these powers, it doesn't mean they've all kind of grown up to be actual heroes from it.
Right, okay. So
it's also given Comixology a few problems so far, because they've had to censor some tasteful nudity with a little bit of editing in of underwear. Is Apple's content policy and the way that they apply.
Oh, right. I've only just recently signed up to that. I didn't realise they censored the comics. That's interesting.
A pair of pants to cover a naked bottom. However, right. I'm not entirely sure what they're going to do when they get towards issue 9 of the series. issue 9 has some graphic, well, in fact, very well anatomically correct scenes of a graphic childbirth, it is all done through research textbooks and everything is absolutely fine in that fashion, but you are seeing a baby come into the world firsthand.
Yeah.
In panel.
Okay.
So we'll see how they deal with that by the time they get to it. But as I say, yes, the plan is to reprint it and then to finish off what was never finished back in the 90s.
Oh, fantastic. Look forward to that. When's that planned for?
Well, at the moment, in January, we had two issues put out. And if Marvel continues to do their mostly plan of shipping two issues of a publication per month, which they're doing with most of their books.
Oh, right, okay.
It's going to take a while. I think it's going to be about a year and a half, I would imagine, from what I can recall. But, yep, they'll get there eventually. And then I would expect when they finally get to the end of it, we're going to get some kind of bumper hardcover omnibus version available as well. But the format that they're being printed in, it's nice paper. The colouring is fantastic. Bear in mind that most of these stories were originally done as black and white art. So it's a different format to try and get that coloured without it looking odd or washed out. But no, it looks really, really good. I'm incredibly impressed with what they've done so far.
Oh, fantastic.
So hopefully that will keep up.
Excellent. Oh, we look forward to checking those out. We asked the question on Facebook and Twitter, what's your favourite Batman movie outside of the Nolan trilogy? Would you like to just... just tell us what yours is and why, please.
Oh, well, I think... there really is some stinkers in there as well. The original Batman motion picture from the start of the 90s was good. It was great. But I still prefer Batman Returns. And largely for the assembled cast, I think, in that one. Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman was pretty much inspired casting. When you've got her knocked down and should be semi-unconscious, you've got the cats kind of licking her back into being. It's a strange scene, but she just carries on this kind of act of somebody who's so incredibly messed up. It's brilliant. And Danny DeVito is the Penguin.
Yes.
It does have these kind of ridiculous, silly moments of carnival humour, but at the same point, I think it still maintains that dark appeal to it, which the original movie kind of set the tone for, but it just has that kind of sense of being furthered and being brought on as a second movie in the absolute best possible way. So many people kind of fail to get a sequel to a successful movie working correctly, and that one just does it completely to the letter to me.
Nice. Thank you kindly. Cool. So, lastly, is there anything coming out in the next month or so that we can look forward to? comics-wise?
Well, as I say, a lot of books are now double shipping. So I've actually managed to get myself a little bit far behind over the Christmas period. So I've still got a few things unfortunately, if I've had at least the ending to one event that I'm still trying to catch up with, spoiled me by the next round of books being announced. I think that again, this year is still going to be very much an Avengers year. But right. What is probably impressing me the most out of some of the newer books over at Marvel is they're actually starting to give female heroes a bit of a push. We've got a She-Hulk book. We've got Captain Marvel is being relaunched with Kelly Sue DeConnick. We also have a separate Miss Marvel series, right, Starring a Muslim hero who is taking on the mantle of Miss Marvel.
And we have
a Black Widow solo series as well. So they're actually kind of finally having the guts to kind of run with these, and Hopefully at least two of these are going to stick.
Oh, that sounds good.
Mm.
Nice.
So that's the kind of thing I would be looking for in the next while.
Excellent. Cool beans. Anyone else you'd like to like shout out or follow? Or
Shout out. Let me call up Twitter so I can get their name correct.
Go on.
Guy that I've been following for a little while now, by the name of Nick Roche. Nick Roche has primarily been doing art for Transformers comics over at IDW. But last week he was involved with this is tying into Revolutionary War, the Marvel UK event that I think we were talking about on one of the previous podcasts. He did an issue featuring Death's Head. Now, many people might remember Death's Head mostly from UK Transformers comics at the end of the 80s, early 90s. And he was revamped again as Death's Head 2 when we went to the 90s proper, kind of the big kind of image pumped up kind of period of steroid heroes. What that book did was it basically paced both Death's Head and Death's Head 2 from different time periods working together against a common goal, and it was absolutely brilliant. Nick's art is incredibly good.
Cool.
And I really hope that now that we've kind of seen him dipping his toes in with Marvel, that he'll get the chance to do a little bit more of it. He is at Nick Roche, that's NickRoche. Yes, give him a follow. He's a really nice bloke.
Fantastic. Well, Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you kindly. You can follow Mark at The Sword Is Drawn on Twitter. And your blog is
It Came From Darkmoor. And every single time we get to this point, I go, make sure I don't get the web address wrong. The web address is itcamefromdarkmoor, all one word, .blogspot.co.uk.
Excellent. Thank you kindly, Mark. We'll speak to you again soon.
Oh, I love Terminator. I really enjoyed watching it again. We decided, a few weeks ago we did Blues Brothers, we decided to focus on another popular film, one of the greats, and it was Terminator we chose this time, the first one.
Mm.
The one that perhaps sometimes does get overlooked, because Terminator 2 is always on the telly, and it's such a fucking good film anyway. But
it's like what we were saying over there, though, with Alien, the second one's the fun action one, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Terminator, we sat down together and watched it.
We did.
I have to point out, before we start, I went out to seek this DVD out because I haven't got it in my collection. And this is what I love about this section, is I go out and buy these films that I should have, but I don't, just because I had them on VHS and they never quite
transferred.
Never came back to me. But yeah, I bought it. And The Terminator, let's be honest, it's one of the most iconic films about cyborgs, of action films. It's Arnie's biggest film. It doesn't really need promotional stickers, does it?
I would not say it does, no.
No.
This one did have a little promotional sticker on, just for the idiot who might be in HMV at this point.
from the creator of Avatar.
Oh, fuck off!
I've got evidence, and I might use it as the podcast picture this time, because the creator of Avatar, like some idiot thinks Avatar's a bigger film. I don't think there are people out there. Really?
Oh, no.
Are we this stupid? Is society this stupid? Or is it just that fucking distribution companies think we're this stupid?
They think, well,
I don't know. I worry.
You know what? They'll be looking at pure box office stats and think everyone's Avatar crazy and Terminator needs the boost, when it's like, Terminator, it's got a bought, paid for ticket in our popular culture. Everyone knows it. Everyone's seen it on film, TV, DVD. Avatar's that forgettable piece of shit we got told to watch because 3D was the new thing, apparently. Yeah. And he's going to do awful sequels that'll fucking fail, and I'll giggle my life.
And it's a waste of a talent as well.
James Cameron is talented.
He's
the mainstream storyteller Michael Bay wants to be and never will be.
But unfortunately now, James Cameron is becoming Michael Bay with his new franchise.
And his underwater camera shooting stuff that sounds bizarre.
Oh, well, he's got a hobby. He doesn't need to bring it to us, does he?
He's obsessed with technology, isn't he?
Yeah, creating new...
Unfortunately, but...
But Terminator. 1986...
Was it?
Or 1984? 84,
I think it was 4, because I remember thinking it was as late as 6, and being corrected going, really? That old?
But we were watching it, and it's very 80s, isn't it?
Incredibly
80s, when they go in the club.
Yeah.
Because there seems to be a belief that there were, and I don't know if there were, but 80s films seem to tell us that the youth of the day was punks.
Yeah.
Hanging around on the street.
We all know they were punks, weren't they, Steve?
Yeah.
Remember when you were? Were you a punk at this time?
Yeah, massively.
I love the idea of Steve being punk.
I'm trying to picture what I was doing in 1984. God.
Six,
so I had safety pins and leather jackets.
From your nappy.
Yeah, from a nappy, I'd stick it through my nose.
You were bad news, weren't you?
What do you want for dinner? Fuck you! Cranking the Sex Pistols up.
Did you have any graffiti on your diaper?
Yeah, I was there, my crayons, fucking tagging myself.
You were just bad news bears.
I was, Mighty Duck.
he suddenly appears in a ball of light and walks across the parking lot in his with his arse out.
Why are
these so punks so entertained and walk over and hey, it's a naked man who's twice the size of me.
Even if he wasn't
a cyborg.
If I saw a naked man that was that big, that impressively built, I wouldn't walk up to him and go, ha ha, look at you. I'd go,
you've got no clothes,
shit, I'd run off.
Yeah.
I would if I saw him appear out of
If a man that big walked down the street with no clothes on, I would think he's looking for something to have sex with.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want that to be me.
He's gone primal. Yeah. Shit.
Yeah. Steroids have got to his brain.
He's either going to eat me or fuck me or both.
Yeah. Give me your clothes, your boots and your virginity.
Fortunately, he doesn't do that in the film. It might have took a different turn.
It's Bill Paxman as well.
We were going, it's that Pullman Paxman fella.
It's
Billy P. Pick which P.
And then emits one of his 17 lines, give me your clothes and your boots or something. But it's no motorcycle.
Yeah, your clothes, your boots and your motorcycle.
Which is from the second one, I think.
Yeah.
This motorcycle came on.
Is it the third one when he goes to the gay
club and puts on the Elton John glasses? Stop it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Really goes down a stupid line for the rest of the whole film. But
just like you're as if it was being like naughty and stop it.
I'm just picturing like in Police Academy him running in and doing oh no where am I joining
in. I hate when those sort of Saturday night sketch ideas become part of one of the sequels, and so it's really upsetting,
it's not good,
don't do it. Anyway.
Sorry,
the first one, keep being
attractive.
You said it yourself, didn't you, that we're going to say it's a Colmesky catchphrase, but the practical effects were very good.
It was very low budget, the first one. People forget, and it's just cracking.
It's the whole scene with his head when he's getting his eye.
When he's in the mirror.
Repairing himself.
Repairing his eye. And it's so just cool. So well done.
It looks better than Total Recall when he's pulling something out of his head, and that was several years after.
Yes.
It just looks very gritty and visceral and real and there.
It does.
And he really sells the threat of the Terminator. Mm. It does feel relentless.
Yeah, that's the thing with these films. It doesn't feel the same in the 3 and 4, is the relentlessness that comes with the villains in the first two is they're not going to stop.
No, never.
You have to really kill him four times before he's dead, because he's still going to get up. Because once you've got rid of the flesh, there's the body underneath. Unstoppable force,
and
that
there's
is
no real weapon forged in any real way.
I was trying to think
way
of the quote. What is it? They will not stop. They will not.
They will not sleep. They will not eat.
Mm. They will find you.
And the eyes as well, in the dark, the red eyes. And those opening scenes in the future where you just see the big things crawling over skulls, and it's terrifying vision of the future. I mean, that's again in the second one is explored more, but horrible imagery.
Oh yeah.
And such an influential style.
Yeah.
In that opening, definitely. You see all these 80s spoofs now with the lasers and things, and it spawned from there. You know, and to capture 80s. America and then the future and things, and put a horrible juxtaposition on it. It's really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And it's the most sort of sound narratively of all the Terminators, where he actually understands time travel.
Mm.
So I love the idea of Kyle Reese makes John Connor possible. If he didn't go back, this shit doesn't happen. And in a way, the Terminator almost ensures John Connor comes into being rather than...
So, you know when John Connor sends him off?
Yeah.
Does he just go and give him the head up patch and go, go fuck my mom?
Go fuck my mom, please. But this is what
both
I mean.
Both of you just...
Go on,
but the first one just really works. The second one, when, like, somehow they've delayed it, that makes no sense. And then the third one, apparently they can't stop it, even though they've already delayed it. And the fourth one, when everyone knows everything, they just get so fucking stupid.
Sorry, there'll be another one soon. Five's coming out.
The first one is that you can't find a plot hole. It's exposition heavy. Mm. Plots it out. It all makes sense. It's good time. I have a real thing with time travel in films. I like it to have a consistent logic, which is why the sequels annoy me. But the first one's so sound.
Yeah.
No, it is good.
In its exploration of time travel.
And Arnie rarely plays a villain after this. He's always the hero.
Even in its own sequel, yeah.
Mm. It's good to see him play evil, and he does it so well. I think the fact he doesn't speak much helps his cause. But he does portray the soulless, blank...
And he looks frightening because of his size.
And he's young. He's huge.
He's enormous. He's absolutely enormous.
He gets a bit slabby. That's not a word, but you know what I mean. Sloppy and flabby, but he's still well built, you know. Yeah. I envy his body in that sense. But when that is just smooth and big and oof.
He almost doesn't look real.
He looks
just really like.
Carved.
Odd.
And he's pitted against Kyle Reese, who's fallible every day. Like, you'd probably think he was a homeless person walking in with a coat and stuff.
Yeah,
I love that.
Mm.
It's frightening. It's a great sci-fi thriller.
Got to give a big shout out as well to Linda Hamilton. Plays Sarah Connor really well. She kicks ass in the second one. She's really good in the second one. But in this one, she plays someone thrown into this world overnight really well. We also noticed earphones and chewing gum seems to be a thing that the hapless friend seems to do in these kind of films.
Yeah.
In the 80s, like,
oh, my earphones and chew gum, hang out. Have sex with my earphones in.
She was the makings of new wave music, I think.
Yeah.
Like the blank, not bothered expression as someone's just rutting away on her.
She's got her headphones on that. Yeah, whatever.
You won't get as many of the cool scenes in a modern Terminator, like when he's looking through the phone book and killing random Sarah Connors. Now he'd just he'd go on Facebook or download, it'd be crap, wouldn't it?
Yeah. There'll be an app for it.
There'll be an app knowing exactly where she is. So.
And he'll detonate her phone, you won't even have to go and visit her, just be like, oh, she's there.
tagged in on Foursquare.
You also don't get the down to earth real people world now. You know what I mean? I felt like Sarah Connor and her mates were living in a real world, whereas everyone sees Hollywood now. You know, everything doesn't focus on that side.
It's glossy.
It's glossy and unreal. Kind of like, and, yeah. Yeah, and it's just the way that film's changed.
Yeah.
But in this good old low budget sci-fi horror thing, it works.
And it's aged so well, because like you said, it captures the 80s, but it portrays the future, so from that point of view, it still stands really strong.
Really holds up, even at the end when it's like the bare bones T-100.
Yeah, Harryhausen kind of movement, yeah.
And it looks all Ray Harryhausen clay, almost.
Yeah.
Still, I love that. Mm. Yeah. I just love it.
And it works as well, because when he's crawling towards her and things, it's so unhuman. And that the look of that animation really works with that, because it's like that really is like a bug or something, an injured creature coming towards you. It's still not stopping.
This beautifully fluid motion captured thing coming at you.
But what was interesting is, for all we say about practical effects, it was actually in the second one. It was one of the first films to use CGI in that way, and James Cameron pioneered the CGI that we have come to have such a fractured relationship with now in cinema. But yeah, I mean, let's give a minute to the second one, because it is such a good film.
I don't really like the second one. I give it a slow descending into the lava thumbs up. I prefer the first one. I wrote a blog about it a long time ago, saying why I think the first one's better. But the second one's a great sci-fi action film.
I think it's a shame, because they did kind of like nicely tie the ends up to never be made again.
Yeah.
And then they just third one is just defines pointless, and the fourth one is not a Terminator film.
No.
It's a Transformers film.
It pretty much is
Batman in it,
yeah. And nothing in Salvation makes sense remotely.
We shouldn't be mentioning it in this breath.
I get so angry when I think about all the plot holes in that film. There's more plot holes than characters.
Where are they going with the next one?
They want to reboot.
Is it rebooting?
The poor director said he wanted to do it, didn't he?
I think so. Yeah.
Why don't we just leave something?
I think I saw an article the other day saying there's two people up for the role of Kyle Reese. Mm. I didn't read it, because I don't even know if it's confirmed yet or not. So.
But going back to what you said about pioneering the special effects that we know and love, it was done so fucking well back then.
Mm.
They'd got this thing, and obviously cost a lot of money, so they used it sparingly and they used it to the best of its ability. Nowadays it seems like we've got these effects, let's just lob as much money as we can at it and use everything and add lens flares to every shot because we can, whereas they were like, shit, this costs billions.
Well, I don't
want to use this. I'm just trying to.
I don't want to upset you, but Jurassic Park as well does the same. It uses and it's around the same time kind of as Terminator 2, isn't it?
Yeah.
So within a couple of years, but it uses the practical effects are amazing and terrifying, but it has to use CGI for some scenes because it physically can't. You can't. There's no way you can do the T-1000 in a practical way without it looking stupid.
Yeah.
And it looks amazing in the way they did it. You can tell it's dated, but it's believable enough and it works.
Yeah, definitely.
But the Terminator, what a great couple of films before we. They said it before it.
It was great. I had so much time for Terminator, and it just went so wrong. Now I don't know what I want, but I just know Salvation was just a bad idea.
Really?
The third was arguably a bad idea, but the fourth was like, ugh. Why do we do it to ourselves?
It's like we've discussed it before, but I'm going to throw it. It's like Alien. You got Alien, Aliens, and then you had three, and then you had four, which was like, meh.
To be
weird.
Fair, I think
it's that.
I think I'd be okay with a reboot, but I'd be a bit wary of being done in this sort of Total Recall, RoboCop-esque remake way. They'd have to be careful.
Yeah.
But I'm almost really for it, in terms of they've fucked it up.
They've already destroyed it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, how many franchises have they dragged on too long?
All of them.
In fact, it's hard to think of one they've not.
Yeah. They always will. That's why I love the sort of do it and get out, like, yeah. Nolan's Back trilogy, the original trilogy of Star Wars.
Back to the Future
fucked itself.
Is the only one who's not been.
Yeah,
yeah.
Lord of Rings, I used to think we did that, but the Return with Hobbit, and I like the Hobbit, but it's still like, can't they leave
still
anything alone?
Nope,
never. Nope. Never will.
Yeah, so go and watch Terminator. It's been 30 years old. Give it some time. Give it a watch, because it is. You don't need telling. It's from the creator of Avatar. You should watch it.
Come on.
That really hurts.
Scott has left us.
He has.
He's gone to build his own Terminator with a Batman style. what time is it, Steve?
It's time for This Week the Geeks Have Spoken. I'm quite impressed. I've got it right again.
Oh, wow. So it feels a little strange today, doesn't it?
It does.
We're in different places.
We are. It feels almost like we're in a radio studio, because I can see the microphone with your face and then the monitor. It's a bit like, whoa.
It's because I've shifted everything around. So I can stream videos on my cinema screen, but it also means I'm now squeezed into a tiny little space.
And it also means if I get really loud at any point, it's because I'm trying to lean forward to talk to Andrew, but I'm actually about half a centimetre from the microphone, so I've got to stay at least 2 feet away.
Be aware, as we are now professionals.
Yes!
Hello!
I can't possibly get this loud.
This is how professional people speak, evidently.
Your face at the levels there. Yeah. Like, oh, it's over 9,000!
I am a bit of a Nazi when it comes to levels and things. And various snacks. In fact, we put a ban on snacks in the room.
Yes, we did.
Because people were munching crisps and I nearly had heart attacks. And people with drinks that made noises.
The books aren't made out of paper anymore because paper rustles when we turn the pages. We found an alternative.
Yes, it's true. It is true. We also... We banned ourselves. At some point we got very professional, because it used to be we just came here with two bottles of wine, a bag of crisps, and sat here going, yeah, you like films. And I think we got to a point where we went, shit, people are listening, let's try and do this properly. And now it feels extra.
Yeah.
Like, I've got headphones.
You do, you look very professional.
I've got it. I'm wearing it my work shirt.
Your headphones around your neck.
It feels very weird. I'm not wearing some form of horror t-shirt. I feel professional. Like, I'm interviewing the hairy man from the forest.
Hello.
Anyway, the geeks are speaking.
They are.
Well, we're speaking. But
we are. Yeah. What's that, geeks? What? Oh, 3-word reviews? Okay. Sure, yeah. So, at Yuzal, saw The Heat, starring Chandra Bollocks. Actually kind of funny.
Oh, I don't like that fat woman in that film. No. I don't know her name, and I feel bad for saying that fat woman, like I'm just being
for
a pig.
Fat one.
But that's what I refer to her as, that fat one. I don't like Bridesmaids, and I didn't find her very funny in it. And Sandra Bullock can be an amazing actress, but...
Yeah. I've heard quite a few people say it's actually all right. It's quite funny. It's not terrible. I'd probably give it a go if it was on Netflix.
Yeah.
At Popular Outcast, 30 minutes or less. Undeserving bad rep, 6 out of 10.
Oh, okay.
I'd go with that, 6. It was all right. First time round, funny. Second time round, I watched it. All right. Not bad. Again, Popular Outcast, The Godfather, always worth watching. 8.75 out of 10.
I don't love The Godfather, but I appreciate it.
And then we've got The Lego Movie, which at Rex Everything said longest advert ever. No score, unfortunately. At Ecos Filmmaker, everything is awesome.
Everything is awesome.
Everything is cool. people went out and watched RoboCop. At Ecos Filmmaker, needs more story. Apparently. At Apocalypse_movie, Erase from Memory.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I get the impression with this RoboCop film that it's one of those that'll be fine and you'll watch it and be fine, but it just won't be a scratch on the original.
Yeah.
I like, in a way, I know you've seen Total Recall, I still haven't got around to it, but it, as its own thing, people seem to have said it's fine, but when you sit it next to that original, it's like, one's so visually
brilliant and the other just seems run of the mill. I get that impression from this Robocop, but yeah. I will see it at some point, but I keep thinking for this podcast we've talked about it so much I really should go to the cinema, but shell out a tenner to see
it.
I
know, I'm thinking the same.
I'll see the Lego one, I'm desperate to see that. Yeah, but
definitely. Yeah. No, at Bobus Maximus again. Robocop, Batman versus Robocop, or sadly inferior remake. 6 out of 10.
And Bob has time for this kind of stuff, yes, as well. I know. Bobus Maximus,
it's in her wheelhouse.
It's in her wheelhouse. Yeah. I thought before we should go on, we did mention Ellen Page at the start of this episode. It's her birthday. She's been in the news. Good on her. Yeah. I'm very proud for her. It's a shame that in this world that becomes news, really.
It is, it's not.
That's who she is. She's a great actress. I don't care about her sexuality. Yeah. Good on her, you know.
She's fantastic.
Yeah, it's like that whole Tom Daley thing in the papers, that the papers went mad because he's like, yeah, he's gay, let's give him a full centre page spread. And surely that's half the problem, you know, like drawing that much attention positively or negatively, it should just be accepted, you know. It should be fine.
It's 2014, let's just, love who you want to love, people.
Love who you want to love. Okay, Batman. We topped Batman today. Scott defended Batman Returns. We asked you on Twitter and on Facebook what your favourite Batman film was outside of the Nolan trilogy.
Yes.
Because we knew that most of the answered would be The Dark Knight, because, let's be honest, it's a fantastic film.
Yeah, brilliant.
Interestingly, only Mark said Batman Returns.
And as you've just heard, his thoughts on that one.
I was very pleased that some people went down the animation route, actually. At the Flickist said Under the Red Hood or The Dark Knight Returns.
Nice.
Which are two very good ones. That's their one Scott
pulls
up all the
time. Yeah, they're the ones that are written on my must-watch list.
Yeah. Angelus0186 says The Dark Knight Returns Part 2 again, so he backs that up. When we come on to the live-action ones, at O'Brunage said Batman 89 or Batman Forever. I mean, Batman Forever, though. This is the point. That's... Batman Forever came up 3 times. O'Brunage said Batman Forever. At Talking Head Pod said Batman Forever, hands down. And on Facebook, Ben Charleswood said Batman Forever. I hate that one, but I'm actually quite surprised with the love that is in there for that one. I thought that it was universally not liked. I found it too annoying, too garish, and too out there. But then again, next to Batman and Robin, perhaps it does look fine. Matt Aspin on Facebook said... Adam West's effort with shark repellent spray.
Yes.
People often forget about that one, but it is a great funny film.
I do love the comparison where he has the bomb at the end and then the bomb in the
Dark Knight Rises.
Just brilliant.
Yeah.
It's a gif.
And then so they were our sensible answers. We got some as expected, some silly answers.
Yay.
Mark Bearide on Facebook said Casino Royale. Mark, you're being silly, but we were actually comparing Bond earlier to Batman, because those early Batmans were, as Scott said, set up in a way that they wanted that Bond kind of feel. They could interchange what they wanted. They kept the same Alfred through it. They kept the same elements. It was said to be in the same Gotham, but things changed. Yeah. Like the Batman, you had George Clooney, you had Val Kilmer, you had Michael Keaton, and it seemed to be a very direction of Bond, but the wrong direction there. James Rex Everything Coppard sent us a porn parody trailer, The Dark Knight Rises.
Nice.
Which I did watch in the men's toilets. I wasn't wanking. I was just watching it to pass some time.
Is that Vivid Video?
Huh?
Was it Vivid?
I don't know.
Entertainment? Because they tend to do a lot of porn parodies. I know that Ralph Garman's always on about them.
He's quite
Hollywood Babylon.
It made me actually think that if you want to send us some more trailers for funny porn parodies of movies, some absolutely terrible ones, some funny ones, some hideous ones, Edward Penis Hands always one I think of, which is absolutely disgusting.
Just horrible.
Those horrible penises. That,
it's just wrong.
He's trying to eat his tea with his penis.
Like,
if you haven't seen Edward Penis Hands, get on
search
it
out.
And at Dr. Norman T said favourite Batman film, Field of Dreams.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. I like that.
So yeah, thank you very much. Oberyn, you sent us another comment as well, a question. We will answer that next week in the show. Thank you for sending those, though. The geeks have spoken.
They have. And just a quick shout out for the blogs that have gone up on the website this week.
The Flicky sent us one about the Batman, the New 52s. We've had a bit of a Batman week, because Scott's put one up as well, about Batman and especially Superman. He's blogging his way through them, the news as it comes. Scott's going to keep on top of that on the website. And also Steve's Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright one came out at the end of last week as well. So yeah, thank you. If you do want to blog for us, do let us know. We're always happy to host your blogs on our site if it's in our wheelhouse. Anything geeky, comic-y, filmy, anything like that, just let us know. Drop us an email or drop us a tweet. We'll set you up a profile and you can blog for us. Just wanted to give a quick follow Friday to at Screams and Moans podcast. I listened to it the other day because I was curious. A podcast about movies and sex, but not both.
Not both. That not would both. Be porn.
That would be porn. That's the catchphrase. A different kind of podcast for movies. She gets a guest host on with her every episode. They talk about a film and then they talk about sex. I haven't got to the sex bit yet. That's exciting. Maybe you can listen to that in the work toilet. but yeah, so far I've listened to half of one of the episodes and it was good and interesting, so
cool.
Check them out. Next week we're having a bit of a Lego special.
We are.
We'll be reviewing the Lego movie, and we'll be talking to Nick Savage, who is the man behind minifigs.me, which is a personalised Lego company, and he's going to tell us all about what they do and his view of how Lego is taking over the world.
It is.
So all that and more next week. I think that's us.
I think that's it, yeah.
I think that's us. Thank you very much to Mark again.
Yep, thank you kindly.
And thank you very much for everyone who's downloaded and listened. We always appreciate it. Yep. Keep contributing, keep commenting, keep liking, keep sharing. We love you.